Sexy and Van City Radio may contain adult content. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to Sexy and Van City Radio on 101.9 FM, CITR. Welcome to Sexy and Van City Radio on 101.9 FM on CITR. Or maybe you could be one of our podcast listeners. I'm feeling almost giddy about using my sexy radio voice right now. But however you've decided to spend the hour with us, we're very, 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 very glad to have you. And tonight we are talking about stuff that, and I'm just going to start it for the top because I find it ironic since my show is called Sexy in Van City, but the truth may not be sexy, but guessing it is even less desirable. And tonight's show is about sex, safety, and security study, which looks at Canadian experiences of paying for sexual services. So I'm very excited because I've got a very sexy man in the booth, which is always awesome, but he is also an educator. He is at the University of Victoria researcher as well, and he is looking to move the discussion about prostitution beyond assumptions and stereotypes. So he is going on the road very soon because this is a national study about looking at the experiences of people who purchase sexual services across Canada. And the main intention of Sex, Safety, and Security is to hear directly from those who purchase sex and their experiences. So I'm very excited to have Chris Atkinson in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Caroline.
You're welcome.
Great to be here.
It's really great to have you here, too, and especially in the studio, which is even way better.
Way better. I agree.
And I, first of all, want to take a moment to applaud you for doing the work that you're doing, because I think it's really important. And in our pre-show chat, I think I was mentioning to you that I've had people in, and prostitution is a really big topic. And I usually hear from both the abolitionists as well as those who are fighting for decriminalization or for legalization. And with that, we don't hear from the other side very much. And you raised the really valid points. When I got your press release, it was like, wow, we haven't had that conversation. And sometimes even when I've had some wonderful organizations on, who's purchasing the sex is something that they're not able to speak to. And I want to applaud you for what you're doing. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for that wonderful introduction. And you know, I agree with you. It's very unfortunate that when we look at all of the conversations that are happening around prostitution, around the commercial sex industry in Canada and beyond, it never ceases to amaze me how silent the voices of the demand are. And let's face it, without these individuals who are purchasing services, the industry would not be as large as it is.
That's very true. And one of the things you brought up earlier today, which I wanted to share with our listeners, was the fact that it was approximately, give or take, around 5 or 6% of the prostitution that we hear a lot about is street-entrenched prostitution, which I've seen examples of it directly just from the work I do in the downtown east side. But the fact that that's only 5 or 6% speaks volumes, and the fact that there's a lot of voices within sex work that is not heard. And it was interesting just as an eye opener as well. So thank you for hearing those voices and sharing the information.
Well, thank you. No, I think that it's absolutely amazing that the conversations that we have and the knowledge that we have is based on such a small surveying of this massive industry. Even if the industry, I mean, throughout time, we've seen the street industry shrink continually over the past 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. And before I came here tonight, I started looking at the population estimates that I have and looking at the percentage of people that I've surveyed who purchase on the street versus off the street. And in this most recent round, I have 6.7% of the people that I surveyed purchase on the street. The other 93.3% are purchasing off street. So that gives you a sense just from the demand side. Mm-hmm. It really tells you how the industry is stacked. And then one doesn't have to look further than all of the ads online or in Georgia Strait or in the Yellow Pages or so on and so forth. It's very clear that the industry has moved in an off street space where it's occupied by men, women, transsexuals who are selling sexual services, but yet our entire concentration seems to be looking at what's going on in the street, perhaps because it's most visible and perhaps because it's most disturbing.
And perhaps, as we were also talking about, just with the Highway of Tears and Prince George, as well as, of course, the missing woman case here, and because it's been so prevalent, which I know that really did need to be seen because it had been literally wiped away for a very long time, it needed to be light shed on it. But now that there is light, and thankfully, like, I'm very glad that Wish Drop-In Center got funding. So
me too.
For that, just to provide some more good work and some more resources for the ladies, and I'm hoping that will shed some more light. But at the same time, while that's going on, we've also seen organizations like Peers Hustle lose funding pace.
Yes.
In other things, so there's other areas, and especially Hustle, which is one that you brought up, that was for men in the sex trade as well, which is really important. That's a voice we don't hear very often, especially since Boys Town's kind of disappeared, since Yale Town has been gentrified.
Absolutely. I mean, men and transsexual workers are historically overlooked in all studies of the sex industry. Their voices are absent. Their voices are absent in the Bedford case. If you look at who is being brought to bear in the Bedford place, who are the interveners, who are the individuals that are have been given intervener status, and who are the plaintiffs in that case, or in this case, the defendants, they're all women or organizations that work primarily with women. Male hustlers, transsexual, are not represented. And that, to me, is a stunning oversight.
Very much so. In terms of sex work, what do you classify as sex work? Because I've also had that argument as well, where there's people who think that being an exotic dancer isn't a sex worker. If there's not penetration, it doesn't count. But then again, when I look at what actually counts as virginity, I think those conversations start pretty early on. Did it go in? Did it not go in?
Totally.
In regards to that.
Totally. No, I agree. And I've always, you know, I've always had, I've been a little bit ambivalent about the way that we define the sex industry. For me, you know, we commercialize such a broad range of sexualities and sexual activities in our society.
Mm-hmm.
When I teach my classes on commercialization of sex and sexuality, I look at everything from the cosmetic industry down to prostitution, pornography, so on and so forth. When I'm doing my studies, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know, you have to make a call at some point in time, it's direct contact sexual services in exchange for money. Now, that could be penetrative, it could be non-penetrative, you know. I've also included a range of S&M and B&D, where we have dominatrixes and doms that provide services, and I know historically that individuals that work in that industry have made a very clear distinction between what they do and prostitution. As you mentioned, have dancers made a very clear distinction. But for me, I do know that people can pay for more than just getting off, or more than just penetration, more than just, you know, oral or anal or vaginal sex. People pay for stimulation. People pay for excitement, arousal. And so for me, that really allows us to think about what it is that we're paying for in a much broader way, and to understand when we do that, we actually begin to question, well, what is it that people are seeking when they're paying for sexual services? And moreover, is it only men that seek this type of pleasure?
And that was something that I thought was interesting that you've brought up, was that women purchase sex, men purchase sex, couples purchase sex, regardless of gender, that there's all sorts of purchases of sex. Has any of it surprised you since you've started the research for the survey?
Yeah, I mean, it has. To be fair, I think that we always have to acknowledge that while women do pay for sex, the vast majority of individuals are paying for sex in the conventional way, in terms of prostitution, in terms of even SM. Well, no, not so much with SM, but in terms of prostitution, pornography, and whatnot, the consumer base are largely males. However, I think part of that also speaks to the fact that we haven't actually begun to look at how it is that women do purchase sexual services, what women are wanting when they're paying for trysts or liaisons or whatever, we're conceiving of it very narrowly. Mm-hmm. When, you know, and coming back to your question about the things that have surprised me about looking at this, yes, it actually did surprise me when I met my first couple who paid for sex and talked to them, and they said, well, look, this just makes perfect sense for us. We want to explore having threesomes or foursomes or whatever that was that were alternative explorations mm-hmm. of their sexuality. And we want to do so in a way where our marital relations or our relationship is not threatened by that third, fourth, however many other parties there mm-hmm. are. Bringing somebody who is your close friend into your bedroom probably isn't a wise idea if you want to keep them as a close friend. Bringing somebody who is a paid professional, who's only there to provide those sexual services for that amount of time, is no threat to your relationship. And that's how they explained it to me. I found that quite interesting, quite a unique and somewhat surprising the first time I heard it.
What other things have surprised you over the time? You've got a smile on your face, so I'm very curious to see what you have to say.
I think that the biggest surprise for me, or one of some of the biggest surprises for me, was when I first started studying this. I mean, I've been studying this for I've been studying people who purchase sex for about 18 years now. When I first started studying this population, I went into it with all the same stereotypes that in my mind that most people have. You know, we've got a whole bunch of individuals who hypersexual or sexual addicts or, you know, some sort of sexual deviance that you know, can't get it any other way or have such an insatiable desire that they have to pay for it constantly. And what I found was, yes, well, there are some of those individuals out there, as there are in all populations. Mm-hmm. There are also individuals who are severely disabled, physically handicapped, mentally handicapped, who cannot, in their daily lives, nobody actually touches them. And they're not paying necessarily for sexual relief. They're paying for somebody to actually spend time with them and to touch them.
Yes.
You know, and that to me is something that we overlook. We draw upon these stereotypes of the perverts, the deviants, the pedophiles, the rapists, the exploiters, all of these things. And in doing so, we lump an entire population of people who fall well outside those mm-hmm. parameters and into that group, and we ignore them. And just as we have ignored, you know, the voices of gay and transsexual people, we're continuing to ignore the voices and experience of the disabled when we talk about prostitution.
And there was a fantastic documentary that you were able to share earlier that I had mentioned to me, where it was a sex worker who specializes in working specifically with disabled, which I thought was really neat.
Absolutely. Scarlet Road. It's a great documentary out of Australia and New Zealand, and I highly recommend people check it out because mm-hmm. it presents a very different side.
Another voice.
Industry. Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important as well, just the what you mentioned about touched, because, and again, just through the work I do in the downtown east side, I know from how important it is, because it almost makes people feel human again, where they're touched with respect and care.
Absolutely.
It's really key, whether it's sexualized or not. And have you found it difficult sometimes to have people share their experiences about purchasing sex because of the shame and stigma that so many of the groups, with, especially in the Lower Mainland, with all the heat between abolition and decriminalization, where people are afraid to have their voices be heard?
Absolutely. I mean, it's something I'm constantly combating. I constantly have to dig deeper, to work harder, to reach out to more people, and I constantly have to demonstrate to them that I'm not there to judge, I'm not there to condemn, I'm not there to further stigmatize, I'm not there to moralize. I'm there to listen. I'm there to provide a space for them to share their stories, to express their attitudes, their experiences, their opinions, to tell me about how they've experienced this industry in their own words, without fear of criminalization, persecution, prosecution, or as I say, judgment. But that's increasingly, it's very challenging because we're talking about a population. Many people make this argument that, well, you know, people who purchase sex, they like being anonymous. They like being unheard. Well, I don't, in my experience, yes, maybe there are certain groups, certain members of this population that that love their anonymity, they relish in it, but I think that it can be a very, very tough thing to be engaged in something and never be able to talk to anybody about it, to feel such, not to feel personal shame, but to feel as though you're going to be judged if you, or condemned if you even utter the words that, oh, I have purchased sexual services. And so for me, that is a big challenge. But fortunately, when people look at my record and look at what I've done, and, you know, they Google me or they look at my past research, many of them, or if they talk to members of the community, both sex workers and people who have purchased sexual services who have participated in research with me in the past or who know me, they generally find that, okay, you know, this guy has the reputation he has because he's not out there turning in people, because he's not out there judging. And one of the things I get after, sometimes I'll do interviews that last between 2 and 7 hours apiece. And wow. At the end of those interviews, the guys will often say to me, you know, thank you, this was really enjoyable. This was like a conversation with a friend, and I've never been able to talk to anybody about these things before.
Wow. Was there any surprises in regards to how early people were started purchasing sex, for example?
I think that's cultural. Certainly, you know, I've talked to people who were born in Africa and in Southeast Asia and even European countries that, you know, where the age of majority or the age of adulthood, or manhood, or womanhood, whatever, is much lower than it is here in North America. I very rarely come across somebody here in North America who says, I started buying sex when I was 14 or 15. Mm-hmm. But I have come across men who have, you know, grew up in the Middle East or in Europe, who said, yeah, the first time, you know, that I visited a sex worker was when I was 15 years old or 16 years old. But that's also generational, too.
I was just going to ask about that as well, because just whether or not perhaps through a parent where they had encouraged both as well as women as well, just in terms to educate how to please a partner.
Yep.
Either way, actually. Yep. Depending on the culture, if you'd found that as well.
Yeah.
Where that's how they were introduced, where
absolutely. Or certainly, you know, I've interviewed men who are in their late 70s, and they talk about, well, you know, that at their time growing up, this was something that was expected. And, you know, if they served in the military and they went off and they were a virgin, well, then this was what was expected of them. Mm-hmm. You know, so there were cultural expectations through their service. And, you know, we see, maybe they see, we'd see more of that down in the United States. We don't have a huge military presence. I don't interview a lot of guys from the military here in Canada. Mm-hmm. Certainly military is bigger in the United States. Perhaps we would see that down there.
Wow. Yeah. In terms of the LGBTQ community, what are some of the things that you've heard through this? Because, of course, this isn't a voice we've heard a lot. What are some things that perhaps have surprised you? As well, just stuff that is really important to hear.
Well, I think that the LGBTQ issue or community and the relationship to the sex industry is probably one of the most important things to understand and mm-hmm. better understand, as I said before, from the side of looking at people who are selling from the community, where it's under researched, lack of understanding, lack of even a commitment to bother to try to understand. From the side of buying, it's also, again, a dearth of information. The people I have talked to, that's where I've had some of the most interesting revelations for me, is as a heterosexual male growing up, yes, I've always been exposed to individuals from the LGBTQ community. I've, you know, clearly we grow up our friends, our family members, mm-hmm. they're part of the LGBTQ community. However, you know, it's a community that often is forced to sort of be silenced by mainstream heteronormative community. When I started doing my research, clearly I went in thinking that this was predominantly a heterosexual thing. And it wasn't until John's voice that I actually started getting people calling up to do interviews who were older gay males or bisexual males or men that were in a stage of transitioning sexuality. And it was fascinating to listen to their stories. For many of these men, especially the ones that were in a state of transitioning sexuality, they were using their liaisons with sex workers as an avenue for determining whether or not they were so-called gay or straight, you know, what they were, what their desire, where their desires leaned. For the older homosexual males, that was where the fat story got even more fascinating, because I would listen to story after story after story as they got older, as they got maybe less physically in shape, as they maybe fell out of popularity within the gay community, they were no longer able to even get a date. The only way that they could get that touch, that sexual gratification or whatever they were looking for, was to pay for it.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's why I think it's so important to really to reach out and listen to these people's stories, mm-hmm. and to have them included, because, you know, they really are they're a silenced voice.
Yes. Speaking of silenced voices, we mentioned John in it, and I think we should probably share as well, because the work that you did with John Lohman as well, mm-hmm. in regards to sexuality and the research you did in the 90s, and if you'd like to share some of the findings and how that changed you in terms of going to where you are now, because you spent 18 years doing this, so it's obviously you've evolved a lot during that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, John Lohman was, you know, my original supervisor when I first started at Simon Fraser University as an undergraduate, and you know, I remember coming to him in probably around 1995, and saying, you know, I want to study prostitution, and he basically said, well, bugger off. And I was okay. He says, come back to me when you've got something. You know, I mean, he's a busy guy. He was doing a lot of things, and he basically, for him, you know, it's like, I'm sure he gets approached by hundreds of people saying, oh, I want to study with you. I want to, you know, do this. And then I said, fair enough, right? I mean, you don't know me from Adam. Fine. So I went away. I started looking into the literature deeply. I did a systematic review of every bit of research that had ever been done on sex buyers, came back to him with a fully developed proposal and said, this is what I want to do. And at that point, I said, finally, there's somebody that, you know, this is what I'm talking about. Now we've got something. You come to me with a project in hand, then we've got something to work with. You come to me with your hand out hoping for me to give you a project, that's a different story. So, you know, in classic Lohman style, that's how things started off. And you know, we got together and we worked on a project called Sexuality in the 1990s. It was the first large-scale study, Western study. We studied America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and did a comparative of people who pay for sex and people who don't pay for sex. It was a general sexuality survey with a focus on people who purchase sexual services. And that really got me to understanding that this population could be contacted, that they did want to be heard. Because prior to that, and even up to that point in time, members of my committee at Simon Fraser University and members of the general academic community would scoff and say, you're never going to get these guys to talk to you. You're never going to get them. And so, okay, well, we got them. In that first study, we got over 200 people to fill out a survey that took 2 hours to fill out.
That's so pretty incredible.
It was very incredible. I mean, this was the back in the day when the internet was first kind of really coming to popularity, the first web browsers, still dial-up connections, and people were basically having to spend 2 hours filling out this very large survey that we created. The survey in paper was close to 100 pages long, and people participated. They participated because nobody had ever bothered to ask. Nobody had ever bothered to try. Nobody'd ever bothered to do it in a way where they weren't coming at them with judgment and condemnation. They were coming at them saying, look, you can legitimately tell us something. You can teach us something. We have something to learn from you if you're just willing to share your experiences. And that's really what started it all.
And what did you learn from that to start with? Obviously, it whetted your curiosity for more.
Well, I mean, part of it was looking at that time, part of our interest was looking at legal enforcement of the laws in Canada, who was getting arrested and who wasn't. That was one part of the study. And what we found, of course, is that sex workers were disproportionately arrested by comparison to sex buyers. What we found is that when sex buyers were arrested, quite often they would get, you know, conditional discharges or at most a fine, certain things like that. And that was well informed. Fine. But then when we started looking at other things about, well, who was purchasing sex? So at that early stage, it was still caught up in this notion of figuring out who the sex buyer was, which I've long since moved past. But what it did show me in that original research was that there was a diversity of people coming from all backgrounds, ranging from, you know, 16 to 85, looking at heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, you know, black, white, and all things in between, but that also told me that I began to discern distinct patterns in and among people who were buying in differing venues, even back then when it was fundamentally different in terms of the distribution. But most importantly, I think what came out of that research is I used that research at the time to test some of the original, at that time, a lot of people were caught up on this notion of rape myth acceptance. Were sex buyers predisposed to be psychologically more violent than other people? And so what we did was we collected data from males, females, who purchased sex and didn't purchase sex, and compared and contrasted and looked at the scores along this notion of rape myth tolerance. And what we found was that there were no statistically significant differences among and between any of these populations in terms of their propensity towards accepting rape myths. But it also began to show us early on certain things around violence and victimization. What we found was that for the most part, there were a select few individuals who appeared to be committing the vast majority of violence and victimization against sex workers. And that really, and you know, it was exploratory, so we didn't, you know, that project was not designed to dig in deeper than just get the basics. But those basics really set me in motion to say, okay, well, if it is a select few committing the vast majority of the violence, then that gives us hope that we can actually put in place or learn enough to put stop measures in effect to prevent those select few from preying on men, women, and who are selling sex.
Were there certain qualities about that small demographic that were, if there was anything standard, versus what all the myths are?
At that time, the sample, unfortunately, statistically was too small.
Okay.
You know, as I said, it was an exploratory study. It wasn't large enough in order to really key in on that. With the John's Voice study, which was a study I did afterwards, my most recent study, I surveyed almost 1,000. Well, I actually surveyed over 1,000 men, 922 Canadians, and I began to actually discern some more patterns there. Interestingly enough, it's not patterns of personal characteristic that are linked towards high propensity for violence and victimization. It's actually patterns around the social ecology. So where the transactions take place and the nature of the relationships that go on between the buyer and seller in those spaces.
Can you give me an example?
Well, okay. You well know from your experience that people on the street are vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we've known this for a long time.
Yes.
The question is, under what conditions are people on the street most vulnerable? Are all street-based relationships equally problematic or equally vulnerable or equally susceptible? And actually, no, not at all. I mean, certain conditions on the street are way more problematic than others. So when you have people who long-term regular clientele, much less likely to be violent, long-term regular clientele who actually understand what's expected of them and can clearly relay to the workers that they see their expectations. So there's a relationship that is there between the buyer and the seller that even on the street does not appear to produce violence. Where we see higher propensity for violence is you have younger people who are out there, see different sex sellers each time, often go into high-risk environments, will haggle for a deal, use the street as a space to sort of get the most. And then on the flip side, you have the sex workers who are in vulnerable positions who are also trying to get something out of this prospective client. Yeah. And so what we see is two-way conflict going on. You have a potential client who is trying to get something for nothing or trying to haggle or try and can sometimes be abusive, and you have a potential worker who is also trying to get things. So what we see is clients that report being robbed, having stuff stolen from them. So what we're seeing is an environment that is basically a conflict environment. Mm. Two people coming at one another don't really intend to actually have this go off smoothly in an environment that isn't conducive to it going off smoothly. They can't communicate because communicating would put them at risk of being arrested. Mm-hmm. So everything goes wrong in those situations. So, you know, you can have two different street scenarios, one safe, one unsafe. And so, again, this question of the blanket assertion that all street-based transactions are equally susceptible or vulnerable to violence and victimization, it's not borne out when I start looking at it from the side of the stories of the buyers, and then I connect them with what we know from what we've heard from sellers over the past 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
No, I find it really fascinating, especially with some of the gentrification in the downtown east side, as in particular, just to highlight, which I know we've heard a lot of the good and the bad of the gentrification, because there's two sides to everything. But I know for some of the ladies, just some of the anecdotal stories I've been hearing are more and more than because of the gentrification are being pushed into darker alleys, etc. Whereas before, for years, they'd be on a corner. It was fairly safe. But now if that space, say, for example, is some sort of a business, a pub or something, they don't want the women in front.
Exactly. You know, and it's this whole thing. It's about, you know, pushing this NIMBYism, gentrification. You know, you push people to engage in unsafe spaces, not only are you making it more making the women and men who are selling sex more vulnerable, you're also making the people who are going down there to purchase sex in those spaces more vulnerable. You're creating an atmosphere of vulnerability, an atmosphere of conflict, an atmosphere that is ripe for abuse to happen. You know, instead of creating an atmosphere where abuses are less likely to happen, all we've done over the past 30 years in Vancouver and in most of Canada is create spaces for people just to go and kill one another and rob one another. And, you know, that's my idea of the worst of what's happened on the street. Now, certainly, if we look at the wider industry, those types of things happen far less frequently. We hear about and we concentrate on the street, but we have to come back to understanding that, you know, even at the most conservative estimate, and if we were to say that it was 80% of the industry is off street, although I have every reason to believe that it's closer to 90 or 95%, even if we say that, then our next question has to be, where is it likely to be safer in off-street spaces? Because we can't possibly believe that all off-street transactions are equally safe either.
That was what I was going to ask, is if in terms of the violence as it's evolved and more things are, especially with the internet, it's easier, you don't see it, it's not as visible anymore. But with that, is the violence disappearing? Because personally, I've never been a sex worker, but just having somebody in my own space would actually freak me out unless I had some sort of security there to protect, which I can understand in regards to some of the houses, etc., where it's almost a safer space in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely. But that's the thing, it's such an unknown. I can talk from the perspective of what I've looked at from the client side and see where they've reported either engaging in conflict, you know, being instigators of conflict, or being on the the receiving end of violence and victimization, and what I and just my observations over the years in terms of, with gentrification came what I call this kind of migration, not just gentrification, but technology emerged. I mean, the pager, then the cell phone, and then the interweb. You know, I mean, these are all technological innovations that have created spaces for people to migrate from physical spaces to virtual spaces. Mm-hmm. Now, not all virtual spaces are equal or created equally, and nor are they all inhabited by the same types of individuals, i.e. backgrounds, education, knowledge, so on and so forth. Certainly when you look at these people who had the wherewithal and the connectedness and the understanding to create agencies and their own customized websites where they could engage in transactions with prospective clientele, and there's a very clear system of rules and a normative order that is created, and it's reified through the interactions that workers and clients have in those spaces. I think it's very similar to what we saw 30 years ago with the high track stroll, you know.
Yes.
There was a clear understanding. You didn't step out of line. It was a higher price to pay. It was in a well-lit area. Richards and Seymour, everybody knew that. Very little went bad on high track because these people were protected. They were insulated. They had, you know, people watching out for them. They had drivers, all of that. Lots went bad on the so-called low track because it was dark. And on the interweb, the same thing. You know, there are spaces in the online environment that go relatively unobserved. I think one of the worst things that could have ever happened for the sex industry was this crackdown on Craigslist and Backpage several years ago by the sort of moral crusaders down in the United States, spearheaded by the journalist from CNN. I think that did more damage than it would ever do good. You had a whole bunch of people at that time who were centralized, could be monitored. You could see if there were underage people on there. You knew exactly how many people were selling. You knew when they were selling. You could actually even monitor purchasing. It was very centralized. After Craigslist, the heat went on Craigslist and subsequently on Backpage, what we had was dispersion throughout the interweb. And now it is increasingly difficult to actually find we're in a stage of kind of what I call resettlement right now. People have sort of trotted off. They're finding their own little spaces, carving their own little spaces. Many times these spaces are geographically situated. So people from Vancouver have spaces on the internet that are specific to Vancouver, so on and so forth. Like they're settling in these spaces. And a certain safety and normative order is coming along with these. But there's that kind of dangerous time until those spaces are created, where you have people that don't know what they're doing on both sides, in terms of the sellers / workers and the buyers, where it's this kind of Wild West of the internet right now in terms of where people are going. And I think that does lend itself quite readily to people who are out to prey on one another. And that preying comes in both ways.
Yes.
You have individuals who are out there wanting to prey on vulnerable individuals who are selling sex that maybe don't know the rules of the game, maybe don't know what they're doing. They've never been socialized or they've never been educated. They're not connected to anybody that can serve as a support mechanism. Conversely, you've got certain people out there, whether they be workers or unscrupulous so-called managers or people who have agencies that target naive purchasers and for scams and ripoffs. So we get this two-way thing going on, and I think that's incredibly dangerous because, again, we have no way to monitor it anymore because thanks to this dispersion of the one centralized area, we have to spend all of our time hunting down where it's happening now, and that's never going to end good.
One of the misconceptions with sex work is that it's a lot of children. And I just wanted to check in, fact, fiction. I know the Canadian Women's Foundation says the average age of entry into prostitution is 13, and I believe it's Vancouver Rape Relief who says it's 12, and mm-hmm. the listeners out there, if I've got that incorrect, please forgive me, but I'm pretty sure I've got my stats correct.
Oh, yes. We have these ever sliding numbers that go from 14 to 13 to 12 to where to, you know, I don't know what it's going to be next. I honestly think I don't know how anybody can make that estimate, to be quite honest with you.
Okay.
The estimate clearly comes from, if you look at the vast majority of the studies of the sex industry, academic studies, empirical studies that have been done on the sex industry, it's quite easy to see that over 80% of those studies are street-based, looking at street-based industry. Now, age of entry on the street may be younger. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen a reliable statistic, so I can't really comment on what the average age of entry on for street-based sex workers are. What I can say is until we have a concerted effort to actually study the broader off-street industry, those estimates are so grossly underinflated that they almost seem laughable. And I can see I would say that they become a vehicle for engendering people's passions and simultaneously working on their fears that this is what this industry is about. I'm not willing to say it is or it isn't. What I'm willing to say is we better get our facts straight and start. That's going to start with actually studying this industry a little bit more. Now, if people are, you know, from the side of this notion of, okay, if there's these people who are underage selling sex, the question for me then becomes, is there a demand for these underage sex workers? Because clearly, if there's this sort of proliferation of young, underage, when they're not, and let's face it, if you're underage, you're not a sex worker, you're not a sex seller. I mean, we have laws against the sexual exploitation of children. They fall well outside the parameters of prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for me personally in my studies, I don't look at child exploitation. However, I do ask people about their preferences. And one thing I've consistently found, and it's a pattern that I find regardless of whether I'm looking at people in the sex industry or whether I'm looking at the general population, there seems to be about what I call the 10-year gap. So the 10-year gap is basically this. Women tend to be with men, and men tend to be with women that are about 10 years apart. If we look at marital patterns, 7 to 10 years. You know, so a 35-year-old man, generally 25 to 28-year-old woman. And this is fairly consistent in our society. It's also very consistent in terms of my populations that I've looked at.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at how old were my average participant in my research, and then I looked at what was the average age that they preferred, and it was generally about 10 years off, 7 to 10 years off of what their age was. I looked at the data coming here before I came here tonight just to see what percentage of men in my latest sample expressed a desire or a preference for a sex worker 18 years or of age or younger, and it was 1.9%. Now, then I looked at how old were the men that expressed this, and I don't know offhand what the exact, many of the men that expressed that were between 18 and 24 themselves. So again, when we look at this, certainly there are in any population people who have pedophilic tendencies, who like to sexually exploit youth.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how many members of any given population like to do that? And my content, you know, on the basis of what I've looked at, it doesn't matter whether somebody's a sex worker, a doctor, a lawyer, a minister. There's always going to be a percentage of that population that have pedophilic tendencies. And saying that, you know, placing all the blame on, or saying that sex buyers or the people who purchase sex, there's a preponderance of them that like children, again, I would call for empirical evidence to support that.
Thank you. The other question I wanted to bring up was in regards to the misconception sometimes of human trafficking versus prostitution, and that sometimes people mix the two up. And if you could just speak to that a little bit, just to clarify, because I know that's something that comes up a lot.
And it's such a complex issue, especially here in Canada, because right now we know so little really about what this thing called trafficking is. We know that we're having a lot of people mobilizing around preventing trafficking, and trafficking seems to be what catches the headlines constantly. It leads, and almost to the point where conversations about prostitution become conversations about trafficking. They're two different things. I think what we have this tendency is to conflate the two things. Are there overlap? I'm sure there is. The question again comes back to how much trafficking is going on in Canada. I mean, internationally, it's undoubtable that internationally, on a global scale, that trafficking is a severe problem in some countries. We still don't know, though, how much of a problem it is in Canada or the United States. We hear numbers thrown around a lot of the times, but when we look into those numbers, the question becomes, well, how valid are they? Nobody, you know, people that report them, how are they reporting them when the RCMP, the VPD, local police have not been recording these things, that haven't been recording this properly in the first place? So where are these numbers coming from? Even if we get beyond this notion of, okay, are these numbers inflated or real? The question is, okay, is trafficking an issue? Well, okay, if we say, yes, we have a definite interest in stopping forced labor, right, of any kind, whether it be farm labor, whether it be construction labor, whether it be nannies in domestic care, or whether it be people in the sex industry, all of those are fall under the rubric of trafficking, and arguably three of those groups are probably more heavily trafficked than people in the sex industry. I'll leave it up to your audience to decide who they are. If sexual human sexual trafficking is an issue in Canada, my question is, who's in the best position to identify and report it? Given that we've got rid of Craigslist and Backpage for all intents and purposes, and we've created this dispersion, you know, a scattering of people in the industry, no longer can we monitor people who are being sold or selling sexual services through a central space. So the question becomes, where is it going to be reported? Is it going to be the so-called traffickers that report it? I doubt it. Is it going to be the trafficked victims? Probably not. Clearly, they're not in the position to report for themselves. So where does that leave us? Are we going to try to get lucky and find them? Or are we going to recognize that the people who are actually in the best position to identify somebody who is being exploited, somebody who is being forced to work or do services against their will, are in fact the people who are purchasing sexual services? Which leads me back to the case in Ontario that's going on right now, where it not necessarily a case of trafficking per se. It was a case where a young girl was being forced to sell sex by two other young girls, and she was delivered to the doorstep of a prospective client, and that client actually turned her in and reported it, and sent her home in a cab, and then reported it to the police. That arrest would have never have happened if it hadn't been the client that said, this girl is underage, this girl doesn't want to be here, she's clearly being forced, this isn't right, I need to do something about it. But the question for me becomes, how likely is it going to be that any man, woman, or couple who is in the position purchasing sex is going to report something like that if they're stigmatized and if everybody's already decided that they're criminals and that they need to be arrested? If we criminalize this population, effectively, you're cutting off any hope that you have of even a few of them identifying where abuses are happening. And I don't see anybody else who is in the position to do that identification.
And I'm going to go full circle on this in our green room chat. Sorry, listeners, because you didn't get to hear that conversation. Wouldn't you like to be a fly on the wall? So we'll bring it on air for you. In regards to John's school, and you're mentioning just in regards to the majority of people, as you're mentioning, it was 1 point something percent that are actually but more geared to violence, mm-hmm. where it's very minimal. But yet, when they go to John School, if they're caught purchasing sex, they have to go to school for 8 hours, and what they're thrown at them is very different than what the law they're breaking. So I was wondering if you could share a little bit of that, even though I know you told me earlier, enlighten our listeners who may not be as familiar.
Yes. I mean, I think that we have to understand something, that in Canada, the sale and purchase of sex are not illegal. It is completely legal to sell it. It's completely legal to buy it. What is illegal is negotiating that sale or purchase in a public place, transporting somebody for the purpose of prostitution, and living off the avails, and also two or more people working under the same space selling sex. So you've body house, you've got transportation, living off the avails, and solicitation. Those are the things that are illegal. Now, with buyers, the thing that is illegal is solicitation in a public place. So when people are arrested purchasing sex on the street or negotiating the sale of sex on the street, they are arrested and given an option quite often these days. Well, not anymore in Canada, actually. Mm. I don't think John Schools are even practiced anymore. I think most of them have all but closed down. I know that it's been a while since many of them are in operation. I'm not sure about the Vancouver one, but I know that the Toronto one, the Hamilton one, the Calgary one, they're all gone. The Windsor one is gone. They're officially still there, but they haven't had any new attendees in quite some time. But again, when they are given this option for John School, they're asked to come in and donate, sometimes as low as $300, sometimes as much as $500 in return for participation for the day. Now, the interesting thing about this is we have to remember what is against the law is negotiating the purchase of sexual services in a public place. So effectively, if they're going to be educated through any type of offender diversion program, the education should logically be geared towards what it is that's against the law. So it's very interesting that when you go to John School, it's an 8-hour day, and I spent a year and a half in the Toronto John School, so I watched this month in and month out. In an 8-hour day, 7.5 hours, the individuals who attend the program have to keep quiet and just listen. And in that 7.5 hours, they are educated about the harm that they're doing to women, the harm they're doing to communities, the potential legal repercussions of being arrested, the health and safety repercussions, a litany of other things that are actually far outside the purview of what they were arrested for. They were arrested for solicitation in a public place. So where is it that all of a sudden John School has taken on this quasi-legal status, but also has taken the liberty to educate just these people? Now, the other thing you have to remember is that the people that go to John School are certainly not representative of the vast array of people who purchase sex. Because the people who go to John School are just those who were unlucky enough to be arrested purchasing sex on the street. They generally tend to be people that don't know the law, come from a lower socioeconomic background, generally tend to be over-represented by cultural minorities. So, you know, basically we're re-educating a group of people that didn't know the law in the first place.
And you're saying that it's definitely less than 20%, probably closer to 5-10% that is street sex trade.
Yes. And I've never been aware of a single case. Now, I mean, I haven't looked into it in great depth, so I could be wrong on this, but to the best of my knowledge, in the entire time I was at the Toronto John School, I never saw one participant come through who was arrested off street. Right. So it's no parlors, no brothels, no escort agencies, no independent workers. These are all people who were arrested on the street in street stings in very specific neighborhoods that generally the stings were going on because the police were called to that neighborhood by concerned communities or an active, vibrant community voice that wanted the crackdown in their neighborhood.
So What's next for you is going across the country, isn't it, and getting more people for the survey. So if they want to get in contact with you, what is the best way? Because I know it's on a PDF on your website, mm-hmm. and it's big. I was, while you and I were on the phone earlier, I was going through it. It's a lot. So.
Yes. The best way, the sexsafetysecurity.ca website, or email me at info@sexsafetysecurity.ca. I'm going across Canada, starting mm-hmm. in St. John's, then to Montreal, then Toronto, Windsor, Kitchener, Waterloo, Fort McMurray, Calgary, Edmonton, and Victoria. So I'm spending several weeks between the 15th of July all the way probably up till the end of August, going from city to city to city. We've been going at this for about 4 months now, and we've reached out, and we've got a sizable sample already. We've had 250 people who have participated in the survey, and several who have participated in the in-depth interviews. Mm. My interest is going until every voice gets the opportunity to be heard. I want people from all communities. I want men, women, couples, gay, straight, bisexual, you name it, black, white, all in between, all classes, all strata. People who have experience need to have their voices heard. Mm-hmm. They need, if their stories are not reflected in the stereotypes they hear, then they need to take the opportunity to come forward and share their stories, because that's the only way that the public is going to understand what's going on in prostitution. And it's also, more importantly for me, the only way that we can develop intelligent education, intelligent outreach, intelligent policy, and intelligent legislation to deal with the issues pertaining to the sex industry in Canada.
Thank you so much for all the work you're doing, and thank you for being on the show tonight.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. And up next is Hans von Claus's Misery Hour. He is an incredibly sexy man to be miserable with, and I haven't looked at his shoes yet, but I'm sure going to have a shoegasm as soon as I look at them, because he has the best shoes in the world.
Where is he?
Oh, he's hiding.
Kind of very pedestrian.
He says he's got very pedestrian shoes. I'll have to take a look in a moment, but he's hiding behind the door looking at all sorts of music to play for you. We will be back next week at the sexy hour of 10 o'clock. Have a wonderful night, everyone. Good night.
Hey, how are you?